Last year, I visited the Sandy Winery twice, which is actually pretty exceptional for me because I definitely do not live in Southern California or even in California. And having to fly out there, there's not even an airport that's really near the winery. If I were to think of wineries that I visited twice in 1 year, that list is pretty small and pretty much composed of Sandy and Domaine de la Cote, which is made in the same facility. But I wanted to make a point of swinging back to Sandy because I was so taken with it on my first visit, and I wanted to see what it was like during harvest up close. It's a young winery, but it's a winery that's working at an extraordinary level. In a short amount of time, they've already turned out some of what I think are the best wines in California being made today. And they're playing at a level that's rarely seen on the West Coast. And now it's entirely possible that I think this because I, like the people making wine at Sandy, have a lot of old world benchmarks in mind when I evaluate wines. And it turns out that the wines I like are also the wines that Sashi Mormon and Raj Parr like, as you'll hear in the interview coming up. A lot of the reference points and benchmarks that they have in mind are the same wineries that I also really like. For example, when Raj says he's trying to make a Pinot Noir in the style of Foyard, that's a very exciting idea to me, and it's been backed up by the quality of the wine in the bottle. The 2012 Sandy Pinot Noir from the Santa Rita Hills is a really good example of that philosophy in action if you're wanting to check out for yourself what they're up to. The good folks at Crush Wine and Spirits have made that wine available to you as a listener of the show for a discounted price of $31.95 if you use the promo code IDTT for me. All you have to do is give them a call at 212-980-9463 or go to crushwineco.com, crushwineco.com to get the good price. It's a special discount for people who follow the show, and it's available for a limited time. If you do want to see what Sandy's up to for yourself, this is a really good opportunity to try their wine for less than you're going to find it elsewhere. Again, it's $31.95 for a bottle of the 2012 Pinot Noir from the Santa Rita Hills, and you can get that price by calling 212-980-9463 and telling the folks at Crush to give you the promo code IDTTFORME, IDTT for me, and they'll style you right out. In the meantime, check out the interview with Raj coming up. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Wines from the Santa Barbara area have been interesting to follow over the last few decades. In the 1800s, Mission grapes flourished here, but they all but disappeared after Prohibition. Local industry moved in other directions until a resurgence of grape interest blossomed in the 1970s. Press coverage of Sanford and Benedict's Pinot Noir from the mid-70s attracted several wine pioneers to the region. The cornerstones of the last few decades have been Rhone and Burgundy varieties, Pinot, Chardonnay, Grenache, and Syrah. In the 90s, big, bold, ripe versions drew some early attention to the region. But now the pendulum swings in the other direction, quite literally, towards the cooler, windy sites near the ocean, and more tense and delicate wines from Pinot and Rhone grapes are currently in the spotlight. In part due to local rules that make building an estate winery difficult and expensive, and also in part due to Manfred Krankel's pioneering headway and success with a sine qua non urban winery, the Santa Barbara wine scene has a unique modus operandi. Many producers there position their wineries in warehouse districts. These are city-like environs, and they're close to the 101. Short drives away, they maintain isolated vineyard sites in separate locations across the region. Some have their own sites, some buy fruit from contracted growers, and some use a combination of both. This norm for Santa Barbara winemaking is far from the bucolic images conjured when we usually think of sprawling California wineries with a big estate in the middle of the vineyards. And yet, it works for this community. The wineries benefit from their proximity to each other. They share physical things like equipment, and the exchange of knowledge and communication moves faster in this setting too. The wineries also benefit from their access to the infrastructure of a city, such as running water, electricity, Wi-Fi, and anything else they could need to operate. Though a far cry from the estate winery cookie-cutter model, many winemakers see their situation as an advantage. They feel positioned right in the center of their collection of vineyards, rather than be limited by the microgeology of the acres around an estate, or drive an hour to an isolated satellite vineyard. Their central location puts them in close proximity to all the various vineyards that radiate outward from civilization. The recent success of a place like this, of a place with a winemaking infrastructure that operates differently than so many other places in the U.S., it's revolutionary. Because it shows current and future wine regions that there are more ways to set up shop than we may realize. Beyond the tangibles of its own unique wine products, Santa Barbara and the surrounding wine regions are a blueprint for a different approach to winemaking.
$7.50, which is very simply the greatest resource for wholesale wine buyers on the planet, is available in many states, very probably yours. Are you a buyer in Alabama, California, Colorado, Connecticut, D.C., Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, that's right, both Carolinas, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, or Virginia? Then 750 is for you. It will help you organize. It will help you sort. It will help you find what you need, and it will save you time. 750 has what you need to do your work better. Check out 750.com. There are so many powerful features, you'll start to wonder how you ever got along without it. 750.com. Find today what you'll want to drink tomorrow. Raj Parr back on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me back.
Nice to see you.
Pleasure.
So last time we talked a lot about your days as a sommelier and getting yelled at by customers and other sommeliers. No, I mean, getting mentored by other sommeliers and learning to taste, basically. And then, but you've also had almost kind of a whole second career where you've done more winery projects, either as a partner or invested in the winemaking itself. And what have been some of those?
So it started, I guess I'll take it back to 2003. I was at the Master in Food and Wine in Carmel, and I think we were drinking an old bottle of Griot, and my buddy Seth Kunin from Kunin Wines, he was just hanging out, and I said, Seth, you know, how come in California no one makes whole cluster Syrah like this? He's like, it's impossible. You can't do whole cluster Syrah and still get good ripeness, and it's not possible. I'm like, interesting, okay. So I kind of stuck in my head, and I'm like, okay, so I got to find a Syrah vineyard and just to experiment, just a curious mind, nothing more than that. So after doing some research, I met Steve Beckman from Beckman Vineyards and talked to him about Syrah and said, can I, buy a couple tons and make it right there with you and kind of see what happens. And Chad Melville helped me with the original project, and so that was in 2004. We were opening Michelmina. I couldn't make it down for harvest,
But from the beginning, Santa Barbara area.
It was always, yeah.
Because all those cats are Santa Barbara.
It was always, I don't know why, because maybe Clendenin, because he was there. At the same time I talked to Jim, I said, can you give me some Chardonnay from San Benedict? And at the time, the idea was just
high from the start, huh?
Oh yeah, no, it worked. He gave me I bought a few barrels and gave it to him, and he put the juice in there. It was made there. So, 2004 or 2005, I worked with Wells for two vintages, from Copan.
But he was big Anderson Valley guy too.
Yeah, right? So we made an 2004 and 2005. Basically, I just picked the barrels. I said I want whole cluster. So I wasn't involved in the winemaking. I just wanted the style. So at the time, from 2004, that I met Sashi in 2004, started working with him in 2006. And all these things were just, I was just basically working with other winemakers, trying to kind of have my idea with them. But I realized that it doesn't work that way. You can't tell, I'm not sure, you couldn't tell someone, say, you know what, I want this kind of wine, and, you can't. So I was like, okay, so I got to do it myself. So
you don't go to Armani and say you want, bright pink suit or something.
Yeah, so yeah. These were all just to be curious. It wasn't something which was, I never thought I'm going to leave working in restaurants, and my goal was still opening a restaurant. It wasn't like...
You wanted wines you could pour at the restaurants.
It was just two barrels and four barrels, and it was under par selection. It was just curious, And then I got more kind of into it in 2008, when Eveningland was planting those vineyards in Santa Rita Hills, and I was involved in the beginning. And you know, it's Sashi and, yeah, Sashi Mormon, my partner, Domaine de la Cote, and Sandy and Seven Springs. So, you know, it just kind of morphed into like, okay, now we found this vineyard. This is a cool vineyard. And in 2009, we bought 2 tons from the Evening Land, the first vintage from the San Rita property. And we also made the Chardonnay for the first time. We finally bought grapes, not from Jim, but from the vineyard, from Sanford and Benedict. And we pressed it ourselves, and 2009 we made that. And then 2010 came around, and I'm like, okay, so this worked fairly well for the first vintage we made ourselves, you know, hands-on. And I'm like, okay, so now we can maybe start, you know, maybe start something and maybe do a commercial project, something a little bit more. And I knew Charles Banks for many years.
How did you meet Charles Banks?
You know, at events, at tastings. He was always at the restaurant or at some dinner, you know, for example, at Carmel for the Food and Wine event. And he was around. I knew that he loved wine, and I didn't know that he was looking to start a business. But so, I called him and I said, you know, can we meet for dinner? And I want to tell you, you know, a project. And I knew I wanted to work with Charles because he loves wine. He's just like totally in love with wine. And I wanted to work with someone who would give me an opportunity to do what I want to do. So I went to him, and me and Sashi had dinner with him in Santa Barbara. And I talked about Sandy, and, you know, so I want to have a winery, a label, which is focusing on Chardonnay and on bright and fresh and kind of crisp, clean. Again, we had no idea what's going to become. So he said, okay, let's do it. That's it. He just said that. Boom. The next day we met the other partners, and within a week we were off. We were like, so then we ended up buying those barrels back from Evening Land, starting a new company, and really found all the vineyards. We had no name, so then, you know, in the middle of harvest, we thought of the name Sandy. Sandy means collaboration.
Because I thought it meant like the beach, like sandy.
Yeah, Sandy Beach, yeah.
It's not spelled like that. It's spelled with an H.
Exactly. So Sandy is a Sanskrit word, in old Sanskrit, and it means collaboration, since we're buying all our grapes, working with different growers and coopers, and, you know, it was just a real collaboration. And really, within a month, we found all these different vineyards, and that's how it started. And we focus on Chardonnay and a little bit of Pinot Noir on the southern part of San Rita Hills. I was very focused on the exact area I want to be in. All the vineyards are pretty much next to each other. The soil type is all silica-based, very different than the northern part of Santa Rita, where there's more sand, and it's different, you know.
What led you to that conclusion?
Of course, you know, Chardonnay, Pinot, limestone is, everyone wants to go for limestone. And what I discovered, I couldn't find the right area where I could make a wine with natural acidity, whole cluster of Pinot, and just vibrancy. The style of wine me and Sashi, we love, you know, no manipulation, just fresh, vibrant style wines. And San Rita Hills kind of, you know, fit in. Because before that, you know, I made a Chardonnay at Glendennen from Sonoma, from Charles Hines. I was made two small cuvées in Oregon from Seven Springs, working with Wells in 04, 05 from Kaiser in Anderson Valley. Then Chardonnay from Brusso Vineyard in 05, working at Calera in 97. So, you know, I went around the whole state, but what I found was that in Santa Rita Hills, it was, you know, we could make the wine very naturally with high acidity and freshness and weight. And that was the only reason. And the other reason is still opportunity. Sonoma was getting, you know, pretty jam-packed, and now it's even more. And you know, just to be somewhere where there's opportunity to find vineyards. So that was the reason I stuck in Santa Rita Hills.
But why that part of the Santa Rita Hills? Because it sounds like it's divided by soil type and area of it.
Yeah, I think one day it's going to, you know, there'll be many subdivisions in the area. So basically the northern part where, so the more famous vineyards are, you know, Melville and Clopepe and, you know, many others, mostly sand-based. We tried, we bought grapes from a vineyard called Presidio, now it's called Duvarita. And we tried in 06, 07, 08, and just couldn't get the same density. And then we were lucky to, you know, make wine from the southern end, San Benedict. And it was just very different. You could do a whole cluster. The pH is a little bit lower. You know, it was, and you could pick earlier. And, you know, so I think that, of course, we don't have limestone, but we have something which is the chert, like the silex-like soils, very basic soils, and a lot of acidity. So that was, you could do it very easily in the southern part of Santa Rita Hills.
So let's take a step back. In terms of reds, why wouldn't someone think that you could do whole cluster? Is it because of potassium in the stems? I mean, why would people be hesitant to do whole cluster on reds like Syrah or Pinot?
Yeah, definitely the potassium, definitely the greenness, how the wine is made, what fermentation vessel you use. They all are, you know, they all add to, you know, why whole cluster is something which people shy away from, because it is tricky. It is very, you know, you have to be on it. You have to have the right vineyard, the right, you know, exposition, the right ripeness for sure. Because, you know, we've all had whole cluster wines. I've made whole cluster wines, which are, you know, slightly green and herbaceous and not interesting. And then, you know, you find the perfect spot and it works. I mean, I love that style. I love whole cluster. Everything we do is pretty much all whole cluster. I love the aromas. You know, I've talked to friends. I mean, my biggest mentor and the biggest influence in my life for whole cluster is Jeremy Sass from Domaine Dujac. He's really, you know, over the years really helped me to understand, you know, how it really works from the vineyard to the cellar, because, you know, it's difficult. I think starting in 2004, I think we just scratched surface in 2012. The first vintage, I'll say, okay, now we are comfortable with fermenting with whole bunches.
Dujac is known for doing whole cluster.
Yeah.
And when you went to Burgundy earlier in your career, you met Jacques Sais, Jeremy's dad, and you identified a Dujac wine. And how did that all go down?
Yeah, you know, that style of wine was my favorite. You know, even today, it's like, you know, like last night I had a 99 Dujac Combot, and it's just like, you know, it connected. It's my soul. I love that style of wine. I love, you know, what the Domaine Dujac has done, what Jacques and now what Jeremy and Diane and Alec are doing. It's you know, it just connects. And just like in the beginning when I went to Burgundy, I was just going as sommelier and just tasting and trying to understand the vineyards. I didn't really pay attention to, you know, how they vinify or how they you know, grow the grapes. I was just talking about just pure taste. And then slowly in the mid-2000s and then moving forward, I was like trying to relate the taste from the vineyard, but also how it was made. So it was, you know, it's very interesting to understand. Of course, you translate from the vineyard, because if you don't have the right resource in the vineyard, I'm not sure you can translate that in the cellar. I mean, there is an argument that whole cluster doesn't really translate terroir or the typicity of vineyard, but I think that within an appellation or within one estate, you can totally tell the difference. Like, if you have, I'll give you an example, like Echezo, for example, you have Domaine Dujac Echezo, Rodrigo Conti Echezo, Rouget Echezo, Munir Gibourg Echezo. Yeah, they might not have the same character in the beginning of Echezo because they're different styles, but, you know, in 10 years, 15, 20 years, the Echezo, the typicity comes out. And I think, but it's, again, it's more Dujac Echezo than Echezo. You know what I mean? So they're
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times, because something's in a minority, it stands out. You know, because it's a minority technique, it doesn't get used as much. It stands out more when people taste than the other facets of it. But it doesn't mean that the other facets aren't there or won't emerge with time.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that if you taste in the cellar of one producer that you can't tell the difference. Like, it's usually pretty obvious.
Yeah. This is all just, you know, we all are curious, and it's going to take us one lifetime, and hopefully with all the resources we have now in California.
You'll get two lifetimes.
You'll get to re-up. Hopefully, so, yeah. Hopefully like, somebody else is going
like
to figure it out.
Like a Nintendo game, like two more lives.
No, it was true. I mean, the amount of experiments and amount of trials we do on different things, just to understand, and hopefully we can kind of, it wasn't like I'm going to call someone in California and say, hey, you tried this, how did it work out? Yeah, I mean, I call Jim Clendenin a lot, ask him questions, but, you know, so hopefully, like, you know, when me and Sasha are like 60, 70 years old and we have a little bit of experience, I've figured a little bit out, hopefully somebody else is doing different things and asking us, because, you know, it's all about sharing. And I think that makes California very unique right now, because there are so many people in California doing just things never done before, or things which were done before but never talked about. It gives me goosebumps thinking about all this amazing energy in California right now, about learning to grow grapes, make wine, and then, you know, sharing. It is, I think, the golden era. And not that we figure out anything right now. We are still kind of scratching the surface, but still, at least we are all together kind of in it and like just excited about it.
Do you think that culture will sustain when vineyard parcels get harder to come by? Once wineries grow from a small size and they're demanding more fruit and people start to bump up against each other, is it going to become more competitive?
Yeah, it is going to be more competitive, but it's still going to kind of, you know, I think everyone who's enthusiastic about finding the right spot, and, you know, also competition is healthy. I mean, you know, it's great to talk about. I mean, I love sharing, you know, sharing what I learned or what, you know, going, like, you know, we have two awesome neighbors. We have Gavin Shannon and Justin Willett from Tyler. So they are like right behind us. And so it's awesome to kind of talk to them and, you know, really kind of feel like, okay, together we share vineyards and talking about just the farming or the pick date or fermentation, whatever. It's you know, it's close. And for many years, there was nobody around us and it was tough. Also, you know, like-minded people stick together. It's exciting.
Because you're in the Lompoc wine ghetto.
Yeah, in the Lompoc wine ghetto, exactly. It's in the end of the world. There's nothing around there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something you would just casually drive by unless you were trying to get there.
Right. It's far away, so people, you know, we don't see that many people, so we get excited if someone shows up.
You're all kind of in the same facility in a way, although you have different buildings.
Yeah. There's Palmina's right next to us, and you know, it's exciting to just have it around us, and kind of during harvest, we all are like just sharing things and having lunch together or something. It's fun.
But back to old world examples that you kind of drew from originally, because it feels like you got some of your ideas about the kind of protocol you wanted to do from the old world. So when did you meet Jacques Sace and how did that go down?
First time, you know, we tasted the 07 vintage in barrel, and then he opened two wines, which I'll never forget. One is two half bottles, 94 Chambol Musigny Gruencher, which is perhaps my favorite wine from the Domaine du Jacques lineup. And he opened 78 Cham Chambertin, which just, you know, I couldn't believe that Pinot Noir could be that ethereal at the time. You know, I never had a 78, and it was my second visit to Burgundy, and my first visit was only to see vineyards, and second time I started going, I was tasting, and that wine just stuck in my mind. Like, till today, you know, Jeremy knows, the 78 vintage at Domaine du Jacques, I mean, they've made a lot of great wines there, but that just resonates, and that's like, that is just nectar. I regret I never met Gerard Potel, because those wines also are in the same vein, and you know, I know his son Nicolas Potel very well, so I get an essence of, you know, what Gerard did. But that those wines also have the same kind of inspiration for me and Sashi.
It seems like it, because, you know, where the direction of the Burgundy project for you has gone, it seems like there's a Potel connection there.
Yeah, and you know, also sharing information, like to learn, you know, because I mean, I love visiting at Domaine Romane Conti or Domaine Loire, people who use a lot of whole bunches, but getting, you know, the information which I can use to understand how, you know, how we work in California, it's not, maybe it wasn't as easy. I may connect it easier with Jeremy and Jacques.
Do you feel like you've been drawn to regions that make red wine with stems in general? Because you've also been drawn to the Rhone, right?
Absolutely, yeah. For some reason, it's, again, this on the same trip, first time I went to Clap, Cornas, and it was like, same thing, you know, it's like, and till today, that was a 98. I go every year. I don't think I've missed a visit to Domaine du Jacques or to Clap since 98, every year.
So I was kind of struck by the way that you had an idea of what you wanted to make and then found a place that could support that protocol inside of California.
It's all luck. There's that. We take no credit. You know, it was just the right place, and it just worked. We found a lot of questions answered by Jeremy, and then, of course, the inspiration for all the white wines, the Chardonnay we make for Jean-Marc Rouleau early on, you know, after tasting with him for many years, and when I said, we're going to start making some Chardonnay, and he was like, okay, anytime you need any help, let me know. And then I call him usually at the beginning of harvest every year, and early on in the first vintages, he used to taste the wine. I used to bring samples over or meet him in New York for the Polet or San Francisco, and he was taste the wines 2-3 times a year just to kind of give me feedback. And so, of course, our vinification is very, very similar because seeing what he does. And, of course, yeah, in California, he's in Merceau. There's no comparison of what we do. But the inspiration and, again, all the questions I had and I have, it's fun to kind of have someone like him who can, you know, help you in understanding. Or even, you know, one year I went during harvest, and we had a late harvest. They had early harvest in 11, and just going sampling in the vineyard and just looking at the cluster grapes and seeing what does it tell you, you know? So it's
what did you get from that?
You know, many people say, you know, you taste a grape and you can taste the flavor. And I think that might be right in some instances, but it's not in Chardonnay. If the grape tastes good, you've missed it. It has that austere, the acid, the hardness. And that's what I learned from Jean-Marc. It's like, you know, he's tasting it. He's like walking down the rows and tasting it. It's very serious. You know, thinking, what is this wine going to end up be? I mean, this guy thinks he changes his press cycle with every different cuvée, every different Ludillo, every vintage. I mean, just so dialed in that you can't even think that. There's a reason why those wines taste the way they taste, because he is so dialed in. He's thinking when he's tasting that berry from Perrier of what this wine is going to be in 20 years. I mean, it's and just like watching silently and looking at just the masterwork, just that, starting from there, you know? Not that, oh yeah, this guy is too sweet or it's too sour or it's too crunchy, but just looking at the seed, the skin, and the flavors, I'm not sure I learned anything. What I learned was how serious he was at just sampling the grapes. That's it, just tasting them. Not taking the lab and seeing what the numbers, just making a decision. Okay, I'm going to pick Perrier. I'll pick it in 3 days. And then 2 hours later, no, I'm picking it tomorrow.
How would the press cycle vary, and what does that imply?
He has a unique way of vinification, of crushing and pressing. But he would, like, look at the skin or the seed, you know, and after the first press, see, oh, maybe it's too dry or too wet, and maybe change the rotations or change the amount of the first draining or, you know, the pre-drain, you know. It's just change things. Like, it's unbelievable. It's just by looking at the grape. I mean, I've seen all his press cycles. It's, like, so complicated. Most people, like, what we do is, like, we have one press cycle. We have, like, you know, of course, it's all pre-programmed, and we'll kind of tune in. But it's not like we'll change it for every single cube, but he will. That's why the wines are so precise. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's going to take, I mean, if we try that for the next 20 years in Santa Rita, we might figure out a little bit. But he's the master. He knows.
And what did you take from Nicolas Potel?
Nico is texture. His style is different. A long time on the skins, you know, a lot of post-maceration in certain vintages, and he relies on texture. He likes like weightless wines, you know, and very much like his father, a lot of whole cluster. You know, the Domaine wines right now are amazing. You taste them, and he does all his, like, he does all his punch downs in the dark. He doesn't let sunlight come in the cellar. At night, he put a candle, and, like, he's done some studies on how Pinot, how, like, he doesn't allow any direct light, no bulbs, no nothing in the cuvée. So he really relies on texture and long élevage, and one night is like he's had like 3-4 candles there, and he's like doing a, he doesn't allow light, he has no lighting in the, and yeah, you should ask him more details. I, you know, I'm still trying to figure what he is doing, but there's something he's doing.
So tell me a little bit more about Sashi Mormon.
One of the smartest guys, you know, I've met. I've been lucky. And, you know, Sashi's the guy, you tell him something, like, you taste a wine, and, you know, we taste and drink a lot of wines together, and, like, he's curious of how it's made and, you know, how it's grown. And then, you know, he'll think about it, and then he'll try to apply it in his own mind of, like, how all these things work. And he, you know, he makes, of course, Pinot, he makes amazing Syrah for himself, Peter Sassi, and then also Stolpman cellars. And then he, of course, knows a lot about farming, and he's a complete package, you know, He planted the Domaine de la Côte vineyards with Chris King, a vineyard manager. He knows, you know, I mean, just to go out there and say, you know what, I'm going to plant 4,000 to 7,000 vines an acre. I'm just going to do it. And let's see if it works.
Because that's a lot in an acre.
It's, I mean, 4,000 is like what Burgundy is, and then 7,000, if you know, there are parts in the, you know, people in the world who've done that, but to say you want to do it like in a steep part of the vineyard in California where there's nothing planted before. So the vineyard, the closest vineyard was 3 miles away, and there was nothing planted around on these hills, and just to go and just to do it, and then many people gave up on the vineyard, and then luckily we kind of acquired it. So, you know, he is, you know, he's on a different path. He's just the way he tastes, understands, and then applies it. That is what's very unique, and how serious, you know, the dedication to really take it from the vineyard to the bottle without any manipulation. That is like, that's faith, because we live on faith 100%. You know, we have faith in the vineyard, hopefully faith in ourselves, and see what happens.
And he's actually has an experiment growing Pinot Noir or Pinot from seed.
Yes, that's again hasn't been done before. I don't know where he came with the idea. He and his wife Melissa, they basically got seeds from some old plant material, Pinot Noir, and then planted an acre in the bottom part of Memorias, one of our vineyards at Domaine de la Cote, and hoping that the seeds of Pinot Noir will create a unique selection of Pinot Noir, and then that will be our own selection. So just that idea, I mean, it's going to take at least 50 years. So we started in 2007, and by the time I got on board the whole program, it was just like, you know, wow, it's like, and this year was the first year you saw there were like grapes, and I was like, wow, like there were a lot of like red grapes. So someday we'll have our own selection of Domaine de la Cote Pinot Noir. So hopefully,
because they could come out white or red. They
could, oh yeah, they're many. They're white, they're gray, they're light red, they're and then dark red. So we'll have to kind of tag them and then kind of DNA testing and propagate and yeah, see if, you know, people said that it won't end up become Pinot Noir, but a Pinot Noir will produce Pinot Noir. So maybe different mutations. We might get lucky. We don't know. It's just, again, in a gamble.
But what would be the advantage of that over, say, using a clone from a nursery?
We are not into like clone material because a lot of it it's been treated and for either production or color or some flavor. I believe in diversity. Sashi, of course, is the reason he's done that, is to create diversity, and hopefully we'll be able to kind of have our own plant material from our own vineyard, which will eventually not be a clone, it'll be a selection. Of course, in Burgundy, they were all Massals, everything is old selections. Of course, there's clones also now, but we are believers in selections. That's why the whole estate, our 40 acres, is mostly all planted with a selection from Clara Swan Mount Eden, so which came from Burgundy and then from there, you know, so we don't have any Dijon material on the vineyard.
Which ripens differently and has a different fruit profile, the Dijon.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have one vineyard, Bloomsfield, which is planted by rows, a single row of Clara Swan Mount Eden. It's all picked together, so it's like a man-made Massal, if you may say.
And Sashi actually grows heirloom varieties of wheat for baking.
That's right. On the side. He has not enough to do, so he decided to grow wheat. Yeah, he has wheat, heirloom varieties, Durum and Red Fife and different things growing, and he has an amazing oven, and his partner, Peter Pastian from Washington, D.C., from restaurant Oblix, they have this bakery, which is also called Pietro Sassi, and they sell amazing bread and crackers at the farmer's market in Santa Barbara, yeah, and from the door there on the weekends.
In the Santa Rita Hills, you functionally have two projects, Sandy, which is micro-negos, where you're buying in fruit, and then Domaine de la Cote, where you're growing your own fruit.
Yes, exactly.
And Sasha makes the wine for both.
Yes, you make the wines, yeah.
What is the history of the Domaine de la Cote vineyard? He helped plant that. Well, how did that all get
going? So at the time, Sasha was hired to be the winemaker for Evening Land, California, and they had purchased a vineyard called Occidental in Sonoma, and then Sasha was planting the vineyard for them in Santa Rita Hills in 2006 or 2007. And eventually, at that time, I was working with Evening Land, making, you know, my par selection wines and together. And then eventually after a few years, changes and whatnot, complications, they wanted to sell the vineyard. And then me and Sashi acquired it with some investors. And our first vintage was 2011.
And there's different parts of it in terms of elevation and slope.
Yeah, so the name Domaine de la Côte, the state of slopes, is they have four distinct slopes. Memorias, which falls into like a clay loam soil. And then there's Bloomsfield right above that, which is on a bedrock of pure diatomaceous and kind of this iron-rich clay, this red clay. And then we have La Côte, and that is this amphitheater vineyard, which is all shale with a very shallow topsoil, but protected, so it ripens the first. And then on top, around 850 feet elevation, is Siren's Call. And it's a steep, and that vineyard is planted, that 4 acres planted to 7,000 vines an acre, 15 inches apart. So it's super dense and very low yielding, really windy. We usually, 13 is the first vintage. Then we got like 2 or 3 barrels maybe from it. So usually we don't get more than...
Of the Siren's Call.
Siren's Call, yeah. So it's a little...
Because the others you made 12s, and you mean...
Yeah, yeah. 13 is the first vintage for Siren's Call. And then right above Siren's Call is an acre of... and Siren's Call is also own-rooted. And then the acre of Chardonnay, we call it Juliet. And the goal was... That's Juliet is Sashi Melissa's daughter. So hopefully she'll take over the estate when we are old and gone, because someone's got to take it over. So that's going to be an acre of Chardonnay, which produced, first vintage was 2014. And, you know, we got 1 barrel from 1 acre. So hopefully, you know, we want to kind of protect it, build a wall around it. If it kind of, it's very special. It's totally exposed to the ocean. And, you know, it's what we see in barrel right now. It has that, the briny, I mean, all the wines in Domaine de la Côte have a kind of a briny seaweed saltiness because of the ocean influence. It's the last ridge before the ocean, so it's...
In terms of what's in the air?
Yeah, I mean, it's fogged in most of the year, and in the growing season in vintages like 11 and 12, definitely more fog, less fog in 13, 14. But so the wines have this saltiness, which is unique to that vineyard.
The bottommost parcel you use mostly for Santa Rita Hills appellation, as opposed to bottling it by itself.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Memorias in 11 and 12 has been into Santa Rita Hills. The western part of Bloomsfield also goes Santa Rita Hills. So the middle section is the single vineyard. And then moving forward, in 13, we're going to have a bottling of Memorias, Bloomsfield, La Côte, and Siren's Call.
Oh, okay.
So we'll have, for the first time, we'll have 4 different bottlings from the state, and then we have Santa Rita Hills, we'll have a little Chardonnay, Santa Rita Hills Chardonnay, and then we're going to have one small bottling from a small block we planted from cuttings from Burgundy, directly from Burgundy, went straight in the ground there, and that is going to be, you know, it's, since it's planted by random sticks just in the ground, it's going to be a Santa Rita Hills Cuvée Masao, probably, that's what I think that's the name, that's what you call it right now.
So 4 vineyards, all planted a Pinot Noir, and how do they taste different? What way are they?
What we've seen so far, Memorias is the spiciest, kind of the most nervy, almost austere in a way because of the direct ocean influence, kind of the leanest of the 4 wines. Bloomsfield, because of the iron-rich clay, it's usually the most bold, the most tannic, the most kind of spicy and kind of more like the red fruit and kind of almost like cayenne pepper, kind of this wild fruit. La Côte, the most suave, the most silky, the most rose petal, most aromatic, also the softest textured wine. And then Siren's Call, it's the most unique of all the 4 vineyards, just being beaten down with wind and the low yields, tiny, usually handy stemmed part of it, because there's huge shatter in the vineyard. So that is the most delicate in a way, but also the most firm in a way. And usually that gets, it's the only wine we don't like using too much new wood, but that wine for some reason likes oak, so it gets all new barrels. We'll see, we're going to bottle it in 13 and figure it out. Yeah, you know, we Yeah, we made a little bit in 12 and in 11, but we never bottled it separately. So 13 is the first vintage.
And something else that's changed in 13 is that you started using the unlined cement.
Yes, exactly. So 13, finally, everything is fermented in unlined 4-ton concrete fermenters made in California, made in Paso.
And those are open top?
Open top, yep. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And why did you make that decision?
I think that, you know, we were, when me and Sashi were traveling in Burgundy, and went to Argentina, you know, just like seeing like the old way of how, you know, the Rhone, old way how wines are made, they were made at like open top fermenters, but, you know, of course there's a lot of wood used, but we had some wood fermenters and we saw that we had some of that woodiness for many years still in the wines. So we decided we didn't want to use stainless steel and concrete was an old vessel used for, you know, a long time. And we decided to kind of, you know, find someone who can build us concrete, and trying to stay right in California. It's, you know, we try to stay as green as possible. Our bottles all produced in California, except the cork and the barrels. We try to kind of stay as local as possible.
But what do you think concrete adds to a wine or doesn't add to a wine?
I think it doesn't add anything, and that's what it is. And also, it keeps the wine during fermentation at a constant temperature. Since we don't chill or warm anything, it's, you know, everything is ambient, everything is as natural as possible. We don't add anything, we don't heat it or cool it, and it just kind of keeps the temperature from the cap and the juice, you know, stable for a long time. We don't usually do a long maceration since we don't sulfur the grapes. So we usually press everything usually in 14 days. So it just, you know, the draining process is easy. Digging out a tank is easy. It's a lot of convenience. Plus just it works for the style of wine we make.
But why unlined?
In the beginning, we had a lining, but, you know, we didn't need it. You know, there was no need to line it. I think, you know, cleaning it is, you know, also very easy. Cold water, you know. I don't know. We did have a lined one in the beginning. I think after I asked Sashi why we didn't like it for some reason. I think it cracked or something happened with the first one we had.
And would open top help you with reduction? Is that why it's open top?
Yeah, traditionally Pinot Noir all made an open top. You know, because usually we do mostly pumping over and all by hand. So pigeage and punch down all by hand. Yeah, we don't see much reduction in the wine naturally because we don't add any sulfur. It's only what was in the vineyard. So if we had reduction, we do a delestage and bucket over, and that's pretty much it. So
because sometimes people are like, oh, when you do more biodynamics, you get more reduction. How are you guys working with the farming?
I guess that is correct if there's disease pressure in the vineyard and you have to sulfur it, like in Burgundy. But since we are in an area which is the only disease pressure we kind of see is botrytis, so we don't use excessive sulfur in the vineyard or any copper or anything. Of course, if we were in a place like Burgundy and like even Oregon, where there's a lot of rain, there's more disease pressure, so then that sulfur can translate into the fermentation then reduction. But we don't have that issue, and then we don't sulfur anything in the tank. So it just, we don't see that with Pinot Noir. I guess Sashi does see that with Syrah, because it's
Syrah's much more like that.
Yeah, it loves reduction.
But you do put sulfur in bottling.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we usually sulfur it. If you rack it, we'll sulfur it. And the bottling, of course, there's enough sulfur, maybe like 25 ppm free sulfur.
So what is your thinking in terms of not using it before then?
I think that we have a natural flora, natural yeast in the vineyard. We've done some yeast analysis, and usually through mid-ferment, we are above 50% non-Saccharomyces yeast, which is amazing to see. You know, to see something which is so unique to our own vineyard, a yeast strain which even the lab won't recognize, and it's non-Saccharomyces, which is pretty cool.
Well, I've never really heard that before. Usually people talk about the Saccharomyces yeast as being the...
Yeah, we knew that we had non-Saccharomyces yeast. We didn't know how much. And then when we did the analysis this year through mid-ferment, it was above 50% non-Saccharomyces yeast, so which is super unique. And if you sulfured it in the beginning, you would probably kill all those, and then you'll be left with only Saccharomyces. Nothing wrong with that, but it's just maybe that adds to uniqueness of the vineyard.
Would you say that uniqueness comes through more aromatically or more in a...
I think aromatically, because when you smell, because we buy in Saudi, we buy the grapes from different vineyards, and we have Dôme de la Côte, and Dôme de la Côte wines always are uniquely different than the other vineyards. And it, of course, it could be typicity, it could be many different things, but we believe it is a lot to do with the fermentation and the aromatics.
What is the degree of whole cluster for the different vineyards? Does it change?
Usually, all single vineyard wines for Sandy and Dôme de la Côte are 100% whole bunches.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we only usually destem the San Maria Hills, the entry-level wine, the Appalachian wine, and everything else is all whole bunches.
Because a lot of times in Burgundy, people who went 100% have drawn back, and Dujac has drawn back, you know, varies with year to year, and DRC as well varies mm-hmm. year to year. Would you think that you need 100% in California to basically counter the abundance of fruit, like give you more savory?
Yeah, I think that was the initial thought we had, was like, we have so much sunlight, we have a lot of fruit flavor, so the whole cluster would kind of counterbalance the fruitiness. But I think that at Dôme de la Côte, if you see the clusters we have, they're very, very small. And if you destem it, you're going to crush it up anyway. So, and we don't have the same kind of mirandage you have in Burgundy or in other places. Tiny, tiny, tiny clusters. And whole cluster just works much better.
Because when I, you know, cruise into La Tâche now and again, or some of the other vineyards in that area, I've noticed that the berries are a lot smaller than what I would associate with berries in a lot of parts of California.
Right, yeah. And I think I was talking to a producer from Champagne, and he was like saying it's probably because your set is so poor, because we have so much wind early on, and because of the set, we have small clusters because of being on the windy part of Santa Rita. I mean, all of Santa Rita is windy, but just being exposed to the ocean.
Is the winemaking for Sandy different? I mean, you said that for the single vineyard to use whole cluster, but is there something different about the wine for Sandy in terms of the winemaking when you buy in the fruit versus what you do for the owned fruit for Dôme de la Côte?
Yeah.
Same winemaker, but...
Yeah. We make the wines all together. And I think the vinification is slightly different. The inspiration of Sandy from the beginning always came with more whole bunch, but more with pumping over, more with infusion and... very gentle extraction. We don't punch down at all. We don't do any pigeage. Just a little pump over and then press, sits in a 500-liter punch-in, and then only sulfured bottling. So in the inspiration is definitely more, for Pinot, is more like Beaujolais, like Fouillard, La Pierre, Pacquelet, and Burgundy. That kind of, just more kind of finesse, more kind of fruit, more kind of, you know, lifted flavors, but a more delicious, like a glug glug wine, you know, just
a little broader shoulders for the reds.
Yeah. So that's Chardonnay is very traditional. And Dôme de la Côte is, you know, we do more punch downs and longer aging in barrique. The wines, we need to extract more from the wines because they're much more finesse driven. I guess the vineyards give us much more finesse and naturally. So we want to get a little more because it does sit in barrel for longer. It's more traditional. It gets racked usually twice before it gets bottled. You know, it's more traditional Burgundian mentality, I think.
Because there have been instances where you made fruit from La Côte under Sandy.
Yeah. We do a small... Sandy has historically... The first Pinot Sandy made was from that vineyard, so we continue to have a small block for Sandy, and the wine is made in the more the Sandy style, so more kind of just pump over. And I think the other day we tasted the Sandy La Côte and Dôme de la Côte La Côte, and even though it had the La Côte identity, the texture was totally different of a wine which never had a single punch down. And then at Dôme de la Côte, it was, you know, it was made traditionally in concrete versus Sandy's made in Terrenso 2 and 3 ton fermenters, wood fermenters.
With Sandy, you have a full scale Chardonnay product that's been released, several different releases of Chardonnay, whereas with Dôme de la Côte, you have, as you mentioned, a bit of Chardonnay coming in the future.
Yes.
So what's it been like working with Chardonnay in your experience under the Sandy label?
Sandy, the focus is Chardonnay. That's, you know, mostly it's 70% Chardonnay. A little bit of Pinot we make, and the Dôme de la Côte is mostly all Pinot, a little bit of Chardonnay we make. And I think, you know, working with vineyards like Sanford Benedict, it's been just amazing. I've been working with the vineyard since 2004, and just to see the progression of, you know, of these old California plants, like they're like 6 feet tall, you know, it's like.
Because they're planted in the 70s.
They planted 71, yeah. And then working with Bent Rock, which is planted in 07. And then planting Chardonnay at Dôme de la Côte, which is planted much denser and a different way. It's just, you know, and we're gonna go on and plant another 20 acres of Chardonnay at this state, hopefully next year.
A little lower down, or?
Yeah, below Memorias, so more loamy soil. More of the wash from the Bloomsfield. And that is going to be interesting because you're going to have like a different exposition, totally exposed to the ocean. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Now, it's interesting that Bent Rock's from such young vines, because when I taste that Chardonnay from you, I feel like there's a lot of density. And a lot of times I would associate my mind with old vines.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the first time we discovered the vineyard was a north-facing slope. And, you know, it's really windy and really low yield. And I think that maybe, again, I don't know the answer, maybe the vines struggle so much to grow that they maybe mature faster. I don't know. Of course, San Benedict should be a better wine every year. And it is a very unique and different wine than Bent Rock. But Bent Rock has a different density. And we have more questions and less answers. So maybe in 20 years when we talk about this again, we can probably say we might have figured a few things out.
But it seems like Sanford and Benedict, at least through the lens of Sandy, has a more open-knit texture and maybe a little bit more of a nutty fruit character.
Absolutely. It has that kind of that raw nut. It has also a seaweed-like quality. It's own-rooted, facing north. California's for all. It's every time we walk by the vineyard, we're like, wow, this is like, you know, it's just an honor to be associated with the vineyard and you know, to have Richard Sanford, Michael Benedict still around there and like ask them questions about, you know, it's just magical.
So what about the farming? You have a partnership with a vineyard management firm.
A few, yeah. Sandy, we work with a few different, you know, we don't do the farming for Sandy, but we dictate the farming, but at Dôme de la Côte, we have our own team and do the farming ourselves, and that is all organic, and that vineyard has had nothing, you know, no chemicals in it ever. It was just a hill for grazing for cattle. So.
And what about irrigation?
Irrigation is something which we pay a lot of attention to, and we are trying to figure it out, because, of course, eventually, at our own estate, we want to be dry farmed. And since we have young vines right now, you got to take care of it. So we do irrigate mostly in the winter months and very little during the growing season, just enough for the plant to grow and then nothing after veraison. So hopefully the vines will regulate and one day we can be dry farmed. Irrigation is a big issue in California. There's a lot of over-irrigation, and it ends up in dilute and just, you know, boring wine and boring grapes. So we try our best to, you know, do the best we can. You know, again, the grower's job is to grow grapes and, you know, get up to what the yields are, and our job is to make the wine. So it is important to, if you have your own vineyard or if you have someone who's totally dialed in and listening to you, because, you know, 99% of all the wines in the world made are made in the vineyard. It's a fact. And that's the reason is things like pruning and irrigation is an issue for us in California. So we got to, you know, get better at it.
What about cooperage?
Since we always historically use very little new oak, except for 09, we had to buy some new barrels, and we try to not overthink it. So, but I do believe that one cooper per estate is important. Like for Sandy, we used Francois Frere puncheons for Chardonnay and Terrenceau puncheons for Pinot Noir. And then we're going to switch it after 14. We're going to go to Hermitage for Pinot and then most likely Stockinger for Chardonnay. I think it works really well. And Dôme de la Côte is all Hermitage Barrique. We don't, you know, New York percentage is usually like 5-10%, maybe 20% at most. We just want a vessel to age the wine, and hopefully when we have lots of puncheons, you know, we'll have a good stable, so we don't have to buy too many new ones.
Because sometimes Hermitage barrels, to me, give a bit of a softer, more kind of noble taste, mm-hmm. whereas Terrenceau gives a little bit more of a cut to it, a little bit more distinctive to the taste.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I love Terrace, so it's great. But just to kind of, we have good relationships with Hermitage, and you know, Sashi likes a specific forest, and they kind of, you know, they kind of work with him, and yeah, it's good. I know that, you know, again, they all are good. I mean, Francofera is good. It's different. It's got a more toasty flavor, and I think Stockinger is definitely stepping up his game, and they're like. You know, of course, they have the foodras, but they're also making barrels and barriques, and it's exciting. They give the least amount of woody flavor. I mean, if someone doesn't want a lot of woody flavor in the wine, then Stockinger is not the one to have. But
yeah, so I get a lot of like white flowers and chamomile with Stockinger sometimes. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's different forest sources.
Yeah, you probably tasted a lot. In Italy, there's a lot of Stockinger.
There's a lot.
Yeah, I just... You know, I've tasted a little bit in Chablis, in Champagne, and just one in Burgundy. So it's.
You've also been doing some other experiments at Sandy and Manila Code, including using a screw press. And how did that get going?
I was just curious to see how wine was made back in the day. You know, it's, trying to do it as, you know, to see what people did, you know, 50, 60, 100 years ago before the pneumatic presses. So we bought a screw press from my fiance's uncle who was selling it. And it was just, and, you know, it's a total manual. It takes a lot of time and it's very noisy and, you know, it just goes up to 5 bars, you know. So, you know, normal pneumatic is up to 2 bars. So we're just seeing for Chardonnay, how much dry extract you can get and how much density. And we did the same trial with the Europress and the screw press, and it's separately right now. And in the juice form, the screw press was more aromatic. And after fermentation, we tasted it the other day, and the Europress had a little more reduction. The screw press was a little more kind of pure. Yeah, we'll see it after a year of aging. Usually we take it to a tank after 11 months, so we'll... It'll be interesting to see how, before we rack it for the first time, and to see how it tastes. But it's, again, just a trial. Curious.
Because some people have theorized that there's a connection between more gentle pressing and premature oxidation.
Yeah, gentle pressing and not taking enough solids, those could. They are, you know, people have said many things. I don't know the answers, but, you know, we believe in oxidizing the juice. We believe in getting maximal solids and getting... brown juice, which will ferment into white wine. So,
you also have an intern working in Harvest who was working with Evening Land in Oregon, but then came down to Santa Barbara and Lompoc and has his own kind of different protocol for some of the same grapes that you.
Yeah. Thomas works with us in Seven Springs in Oregon, and he worked Harvest. In the first part of Harvest, he worked with us at the La Côte, and he went to school in Burgundy. And then he worked at in the vineyards of Domaine du Jacques and with Potel and also Domaine de Romney Conti. So we gave him a tank to kind of play with, and he did some, he like flambéed the tank, like burnt like vodka basically in a wood tank. And you know, just different protocol of what we do. And the kind of his inspiration was wines he's been turned in Burgundy. So that we kept that fermentation separate, even though it's from, I think it was Bloomsfield, yeah. And it's aging separately to see, you know, see what happens. It's just, you know, another trial, another one of our, trials to see.
And you got some Trousseau in this year.
Oh, yeah. Again, for fun, you know, it was, there's no Trousseau in Santa Barbara. So we got some cuttings from Arnold Roberts from the Lushinger Vineyard and grafted them on Sangiovese at Stolpman in Ballard Canyon. And 1 acre. And this year we made a little Trousseau, whole cluster and concrete. And then we, so it's aging also in a closed concrete tank now. And we also made a little Trousseau Noir Pet Nat. So whole cluster pressed and natural sparkling. It's going to be bottled in a crown cap probably in the spring or summer. Just a fun little, I don't know, just to see what happens.
How's it looking so far?
Tastes delicious, yeah. Yeah, the Trousseau Noir tastes very pale, super aromatic and really fruity, and just how Trousseau is, simple, quaffable wine. And the Pet Nat is delicious, yeah. I can't wait to, get it out there.
And you also have a fun project with the Arnott Roberts guys for the last few years, doing a little Gamay.
Oh, yeah, those guys are, they are huge inspirations in my life. And dear, dear friends, and what they do is just amazing. What they do with different grape varieties and in you know, Santa Cruz and the North Coast. So we were in the Rhone together, like, what about 2010 or around there, and we were just like, just, you know, we're tasting Syrah, but we're like always talking about Gamay restaurants. We go, we always like drinking Beaujolais, and we're like, oh, I wonder if there's any Gamay in California. And we decided to like hunt out some vineyards, and with the help of Steve Edmonds, we found two vineyards in the Sierra foothills and on pink granite. I mean, really like crazy pink granite. So we started a small label, RPM, Robert Spar Myers, all our last names, and we make a little bit of Gamay there. So the wine is made in Healdsburg at Arnold Roberts, and hopefully eventually we'll do something else, another little Gamay somewhere else. So, you know, it's a very small project. It's a huge learning experience, and basically to make Gamay so we can drink some ourselves, and hopefully, you know, again, another one of those wild California trials, which kind of works for us, and it's a fun collaboration and makes me go see them often, and yeah, it's great.
But it seems like some of the technique in terms of making the wine has changed a bit for that.
Yeah, so in 11, 12, 13, we were still kind of, you know, we had very small lots, different picks from both the vineyards, and then when the new vineyard planted came online, so now we have like a decent quantity we can ferment separately, and you know fermenting one ton is very hard. I mean, if you're two or three tons, it's like, you know, so we did full.
And the reason it's hard is because the fermentation doesn't get started.
It doesn't get started in the vessel, and it's just, you know, the extraction is not the right extraction. So finally in 14, we had, you know, a decent quantity of ferment separately, and we did 100% carbonic pressed early, very classic Beaujolais style. And the wines are delicious. It's totally like a different, finally we kind of like after 4 years, we are in a different path. So this is, it takes a while to figure it out.
And you recently announced that you were going to be involved with the Evening Land in Oregon, and you were doing harvest there for the first time this year.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, we took over the Seven Springs Vineyard, a historic vineyard planted in the 80s, Gamay and Pinot Noir, and some Chardonnay planted from 1995. And super excited, you know. It's the vintage this year was unbelievable, and it works because after I finish the harvest in Santa Rita, go to Oregon and spend a month there, and we have a great team working with us, and it's, you know, it's just to work with the historic vineyard, it's a biodynamic vineyard. Dominic Lafon is our consultant. He's a good friend, so it's kind of awesome to kind of work with him and learn about the vineyard, and couldn't be happier with this vintage there.
What was that like with this vintage?
It was early, very, very short growing season, but the wines are super aromatic. It's the first time we used our whole cluster there. You know, we made the wines in the same way. There was, you know, we didn't use any sulfur or any additives. Everything was made ambient, you know, lots of pump overs. So, you know, just keeping the wine in the same kind of, it's a sister property to Domaine de la Cote. So it's of course, has to be made in a similar way. And that's what he did. Of course, it's Oregon. It's different. The grapes are different. The numbers are different. The aromatics are different. But the inspiration is the same. The stylistically, it's going to be, a similar wine to Domaine de la Cote. So we'll see. We'll see how the élevage is. And after Malo's done, it's again another learning experience.
Did it surprise you, the heat? I mean, it sounds like
it was hot. It was really warm. Yeah, I was surprised because just usually when we record every year, you know, starting off, bud break and flowering, middle flowering. And then, you know, I'm expecting, so we're going to start picking like September 16, 17. That's like around 95 days from middle flowering. And, you know, we looked at the numbers and I got there on, I think, the 5th or 6th September. I'm like, wow, we got to pick it tomorrow. So we picked it really early, and we picked everything within, like, I think 11 days. And then looking at the numbers from mid-flowering to picking, they were all like 85 days, 90 days. So it was it was extreme heat. I mean, you know, we don't get 100-degree weather in Santa Rita Hills during harvest. You know, we might get 90s, but not 100. You know, it was very warm. But, old vines, and they were very stable. The young vines were very, you know, they were pushing, and so you had to kind of pick them and keep the acidity. And that's key. That's the style of Seven Springs. That's has been since Evening Labs made it, and we kept the same kind of idea. And that's my style personally also. So it worked well.
And what did Dominique Lafon tell you?
He said, don't mess it up. No, you know, Navi, we're just, you know, he's really amazing with the vineyard, and he took the vineyard from where it started to biodynamic, and, you know, the vine health is amazing. The canopy is great. He really, you know, helped me understand the vineyard, and, you know, it was fun to make all these different blocks planted to different clone material, different, some no rootstock, some have phylloxera. So it's, you know, it was amazing to see all these different aspects and different parts of vineyards, all just totally different, but we were making it almost exactly the same way. So it was, they were all treated the same way. So it was pretty interesting to, yeah, to see the whole process.
You have a project in Burgundy these days, the Maison Loire.
Yeah, it's a small negos, which we started in 2009, tiny, you know, we shared the space with Nico Portel since then, and now we've taken over the old Evening Land, the Chateau Brigny space, so the wines are going to be made there from next vintage, and the élevage is going to be there, so very small, you know, around a total of 1,000 cases of different appellations, which I love, and we have Matt Chittick, who's our, you know, he works with Nico, and he takes care of the wines, he makes the wines for Maison Loire, and in Beaune, yeah.
But you have Côte de Beaune and Côte de Nuit there. You're making Chambon Mousonie.
Yeah, exactly. We have some Meursault, Meursault Charme, Chambon, Vaughan Village, Gevrey Village, Gevrey Champeau. So, you know, just some appellations I love, and in small quantities, and, you know.
What's it like to be a micro-negos in Burgundy today?
It's challenging. It seemed easy in the beginning, but then, you know, everyone wants the grapes, everyone wants the juice, and it's expensive, and hopefully, you know, we can make it and make a business out of it, which we won't have to, you know, lose our pants on. So, but it's expensive. It's tough. You know, it's not easy to find the right vineyards to work with and the right growers. But you know, it's another experience, another challenge.
So when you buy grapes, how do they arrive? They arrive in a truck, or
usually we are in 9, 10 all the way. We bought mostly juice, in some instances grapes, and you know, Nico's team, they pick it and then they'll bring it back to the cellar, and it's made in Savigny-le-Beaune, where the negos is, his own negos is. So, but moving forward, it's gonna, you know, be made at Chateau de Brigny, where there's, you know, the whole winery is set up. It's got tanks and everything there, so it's gonna be made there.
And what's next for Raj Parr? It seems like
this is it. there's nothing else. This is, you know, just to take care of Domaine de la Côte, Seven Springs, or, you know, our estates there, and then to fine-tuning and learning more, and yeah, this is pretty much it.
What have been some of the most important realizations for you?
Believe in yourself and have faith, you know. That's what me and Sashi always, you know, because it's always been like people have always doubted us, and they will continue probably. And
you're talking about me.
Oh, no, not you. You know, it's fine. You know, it's like all my life I came from India. You know, there was nothing taken for granted. It's not like someone gives you something and, oh, this is mine, I deserve this. No, we deserve nothing. But we realize that, you know, we are doing a few things and we are relying all on faith, and the doubters can doubt. So we just continue doing our own thing.
The doubts have tended to center on the issue of alcohol, which hasn't even come up during this interview. What would you say about alcohol levels for?
Again, we make the wines, we grow the grapes of what we like drinking ourselves. So it doesn't matter. You know, I have nothing against anything. I love Chateauneuf du Pape. Yeah. I mean, I don't drink a lot of it. You know, it's all over 14, 15%. I love Barolo. Everything is over 14%. It doesn't matter. You know, I think the topic is taken out of context of alcohol. Of course, for purity of fruit, for Pinot, Chardonnay, I like more delicate wines, you know. I mean, yeah, I love Freddie Mounier. Do I love his 09s? Yeah, it's not my style. It's just style. I like Freddie Mounier. Yeah, and I'm sure the 09s, which are much bigger, will, you know, soften up in 10, 15, 20 years. And that's fine. But that doesn't mean that I'm against him or his, like, one vintage. Or, you know, somebody made, you know, we made a wine in 2011, Redux Grand Chardonnay. It was 13.9 degrees of alcohol. I didn't measure it and say, oh, it has to be under 14. The pH was 3.1. The acidity picked was 9 grams of TA. So it doesn't equate always that you have to be at this alcohol or that alcohol. Yeah, you know, it's exaggerated. I made a rule in at RN74 in 2009, and It was what it was, you know. It was just something we did at the time, and it exaggerated into something else. And then, you know, the press makes a different story out of it. So it's taken out of context.
The press has its own cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
But it seems like you don't even pick on bricks when you pick.
No. So. Once it gets to 20 or 21, we can't stop checking it. We just like, acidity, mostly acidity, yeah.
Back to those tastes in those grapes again, walking the rows of rows.
Exactly, 100% on taste, yeah. And then, well, we do make mistakes sometimes. Oh, it tastes great, let's pick it. Okay, hang on, let's just check the bricks just for in case. Oh, it's only 19.2. Oh, okay, let's just wait. You know, we're not afraid of making a 12% alcohol wine, not afraid of making a 14% alcohol wine. You know, we've done trials and picked in a little bit much later, and we've, you know, ended up making a wine at 14.5. We had a wine in 2012 at 14.9. Of course, it went into the Center Hills blend, but it was a trial. We wanted to see how the, you know, we kept the wine in a barrel all the way till, you know, till the end, until we blended in into the Center Hills. So we keep trying. It's not, I think we get ripeness at lower sugars, but that's just us, you know. And
so Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, Santa Rita Hills, a little bit of Trousseau, Gamay in Healdsburg, at least that's where it's made, Oregon Seven Springs, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir. You got the project in Burgundy. I know you're a big lover of Syrah, so where are you hiding the Syrah winery? and where's the Riesling winery? You got something in the Rheingau you don't want to tell me about?
No. We have... You know, I'm surrounded by Syrah and Tolpman and Sashi's own wine. So, yeah, we do a little Syrah. We just, you know, we haven't released it yet. It's 2012. It's still in bottle. We do a carbonic Syrah. It'll come out at some point. Just a little bit. One fermenter for fun, you know. Just a little homage, inspiration from Thierry Allemande, you know. A little Sun Tzu of Syrah. So that's it. It's a fun project. Nothing serious, nothing big, commercial. Like one fermenter.
Raj Parr, he's been inspired by mentors in the old world, and he's having fun in a new world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Raj Parr of several different winery projects, including RPM, Maison Loree, Sandy, Domaine de la Cote, and the Evening Land Seven Springs project in Oregon. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Hey, just a reminder, if you're interested in picking up the 2012 Sandy Pinot Noir from the Santa Rita Hills, Crush Wine Co. has a special offer for you. It's $31.95 a bottle at a discounted price from Crush. If you give them a call at 212-980-9463 or go to crushwineco.com and use the promo code IDTT for me. It's a very good example to check in with what Sandy's up to. Are you around New York on February 23rd? If so, I want you to know that I'm moderating a seminar on how wines age with a tremendous lineup of California Pinot Noir producers. Jeffrey Patterson of Mount Eden, Josh Jensen from Calera, and Ted Lemon from Literai will be bringing older wines direct from their cellars to share. Those bottles are going to have significant age on them, and we'll be discussing vintages and ageability while trying the wines. This is a public seminar, and tickets are only $125 a person for the opportunity to drink fantastic examples and listen to the people who were there and who crafted them. It's going to be really insightful, and you can find more information or purchase tickets at InPursuitOfBalance.com. That's InPursuitOfBalance.com, spelled out. It will be In Pursuit of Balance in New York City on Monday, February 23rd. It will be the first seminar of the day, and I really hope to see you there. We'll be drinking well, and you can join us. That was our show. If you're curious about what we're up to in the future, check us out on Facebook. Give us a like, and you'll see all our fancy posts. It's I'll Drink to That, Talking Wine with Levy Dalton is a Facebook fan page. Hey, fan page. Yeah. We're on Twitter at Drink to That Pod. And we're also up on Instagram. Some pretty artistic shots sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes good, though. At Levy Opens Wine. And then I got to tell you, we're also got our own website there. It's alldrinktothatpod.com, where you can stream stuff off of it or download direct episodes so you don't have to go through iTunes if you don't want to. We like to give options. We're about options here. So lots to do, lots to think about. Maybe you want a t-shirt. Maybe you like a fancy, well, they're not that fancy, but they're pretty cool. I'll Drink to That t-shirt of your very own in a variety of different colors, shapes, sizes, onesies even. I mean, you can get onesies, you can get tanks, you can get biker tanks, you can get tees, you can get other stuff, hoodies, for God's sakes. It's all up there. You can find the information up on our website if you'd like to check it out and wear what you hear. And then there's also that possibility you could shoot us some real support. Shoot us a little dough. Help keep the microphones rolling. We are here because of dedication, because of love, because of interest. But we're also here because we make the finances work, and we could always use a little help with that. Thanks for your consideration.